All right. Good evening to everybody. We tonight are taking a break from our normal scheduled shiur on tefillah, and we are going to tangent onto inyana diyema, right? To current events or to the topic of the day, which is Purim. Tomorrow is Tanit Esther, and on Sunday is Purim. So I give tonight's shiur with a asterisk that I am woefully under qualified and underprepared to give the shiur that we're giving tonight because I simply don't know enough about the parodies and the piyutim that were written for Purim. I bit off more than I can chew this week, and the amount of piyutim and parodies that were written over the past 2,000 years was really overwhelming. So tonight I'll share with you what it is that I learned about this week, and much of the content that I thought was interesting. And Be'ezrat Hashem, as the years go by, I'll learn more and I'll share more, and we'll all have a fun journey, so to speak. Now, if we think about the liturgy of Purim from the very earliest era, we could think to ourselves about the Kriyat HaMegillah, right? We read right here on the Bima, we read the Megillah on the night of Purim, and we say the brachot, those brachot which come in the Mishnayot and Megillah, and the entire liturgical schedule and program of the Kriyat HaMegillah does bring a significant element of Purim into the synagogue itself, right? But other than the Kriyat HaMegillah, the additions to the liturgy itself on Purim are extremely minor. We know, for example, that the Tosefta instructs us, and this is already very early, around the time of the Mishnah, the Tosefta instructs us to add into the Shmona Esrei Ma'en HaMe'orah. So says the Tosefta, Kol She'en Bo Musaf Kigon Chanukah, Purim, Arvit, Shachrit, U'Mincha, Mitpalel Shmona Esrei, Ve'omer Me'en HaMe'orah, Behoda'ah. Right? Right from here in the Tosefta, we see that. Give me one second. Yeah. Right from here in the Tosefta, we see that the addition to the liturgy of Purim was really minor. In the time of the Mishnah, they didn't even have a name or a set liturgy for this addition to Modim. Like today, we know it as Al HaNisim, but that wasn't an instant development. As I discussed in previous Shiurim, Al HaNisim as a prayer can only be traced to the early Gaonic era. That's the earliest we could really find it. In the time of the early Gaonim in Eretz Yisrael, we find such a prayer being composed. Also, in Bavel, they borrowed extensively from the prayer in Eretz Yisrael. And what ended up happening was that the Jews of Eretz Yisrael developed a nusach called Kinnisei Pila'echa, like the miracles of your wonders that you perform. Socially, you perform wonders for us, a very short prayer, while our prayer, Al HaNisim, is more extensive. Regardless, Al HaNisim itself is a really short, really, what's it called? Minimal addition to the Purim liturgy itself. Now, you might One who knows a lot about Piyut might expect say to themselves, "Well, I know. If you're going to think if someone was going to add, if one was going to add extra elements to the liturgy on Purim, it wouldn't be on the day of Purim itself, because if you think about it, the day of Purim itself, people are busy. They don't want to really stick around in shul. They want to go have fun, drink, be merry. In shul itself, perhaps I won't find many Piyutim." And I won't find many expansions to the liturgy, but not on the day of Purim, such as Ta'anit Esther. Maybe on Ta'anit Esther, that's where all the piyutim are. Maybe there are kinot from Eretz Yisrael or slichot from Bavel. Perhaps in that era, I can find, just like Rabbi Elazar HaKalir has so many piyutim for Tisha B'Av, maybe Rabbi Elazar HaKalir wrote piyutim and kinot or slichot for, well, not slichot because that wasn't their genre, but at least kinot for Ta'anit Esther. Perhaps he wrote some sort of inspirational thing for Ta'anit Esther. And the comedy to that assumption is that in Eretz Yisrael, they didn't have Ta'anit Ester. What many people who aren't fluent in halacha don't know is that Ta'anit Ester is not a Talmudic fast. It doesn't come from the Gemara. Ta'anit Ester was invented after the time of the Gemara. And Ta'anit Ester is really a custom that developed in Bavel in the time of the Geonim. So in Eretz Yisrael, they simply didn't have this custom of fasting the on Yud Gimel Adar. Rather, they had a custom of fasting Behab, meaning Monday, Thursday, Monday after Ta'anit Ester. And this custom pervaded into the Middle Ages. The Machaber also mentions this custom, not instead of Ta'anit Ester, but in addition to Ta'anit Ester. Another fact people don't know is that it's impossible that during Bayit Sheni, anybody would have fasted Ta'anit Ester. Why? Because if you look in Megillat Ta'anit, in the actual list of Tanoic era days which were prohibited from fasting, Yud Gimel Adar is one of those days. Yud Gimel Adar is called Yom Nikanor. It was a celebration in the time of the Second Temple for the day when Yehuda HaMaccabee defeated General Nikanor from the Roman army. And this defeat of this miraculous defeat of Judas Maccabeus was immortalized in this holiday called Yom Nikanor on Yud Gimel Adar. It was only after the Churban, during the time of the later Tanaim, when the Megillat Ta'anit fell into disuse, that it was possible for a day like this to be used as a fast, because otherwise it was strictly prohibited in the Megillat Ta'anit, which is a list of days in which you do not fast. So that's just a little known history of Ta'anit Ester. And that's why we don't find Yossi Ber Yossi, Rabbi Elazar Kalir, or Rav Pinchas HaKohen, or any of the great Paitanim from Eretz Yisrael. We don't find them writing Piyutim for the Ta'anit of Ester. Rather, we only find them writing Piyutim for the day of Purim itself. Now, because the day of Purim has a normal Shmona Esrei, therefore, the type of kirova, the type of poetic uvra, which they would write for the liturgy, had to be a poetry which fit into 18 brachot of Shmona Esrei. Now, the academics call this a krovat yudchet. They call this a krova written for the 18 blessings of Shmona Esrei. And what this essentially does is that it replaces the standard 18 blessings of the Shmona Esrei with the 18 blessings the 18 poems of the Paitan. And Rabbi Elazar HaKalir has a very famous one called Vayehav Omen. This one was said up until the Middle Ages, and it's fairly easy to find. You can even find some Sfarim, which have a whole Pirush on it. There's a shorter version of it. There's a longer version of it. But Vayehav Omen, Kalir's version of this Krovat Yudchet, although it's not funny at all, and it's really just a Krovat for Purim, was popular in many Ashkenazi kilot for the Purim day. Now, the caveat there is that it's not very long. It's kind of a short, one of his shorter poems. And it's probably because nobody would have had the patience on Purim for a much longer set of Piyutim. That's just my assumption. Perhaps people were enthusiastic about the poetry, but my feeling is that nobody really had the time for a much longer one. Now, again, in Eretz Yisrael, in the sphere of Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, they didn't really say Kedusha on a day which didn't have Musaf. So Purim, Chanukah, there was no Musaf on those days, and therefore, there's no Kedusha. It was only later, in like the 10th, maybe 9th centuries, when the people in Eretz Yisrael began to adopt some of the Babylonian customs that we find that some people in Eretz Yisrael added Kiddusha to Purim. Now, one of those Piyutim, one of the later Piyutim that has, one of those later Piyutim from the Geniza that we have does have extra expansions for the Kiddusha. And in other words, instead of just being a regular krova for the 18 brachot Shmona Esrei, it also has an extra expansion to introduce the kedusha. Now, this is the first time, at least in the synagogal poetry, that we find something that seems to be like a joke. It's not clear if this is quoting a midrash that we just don't know about, or if the Paitan is just trying to be funny. It says, "Vayomer Malach." Let's go start from top. Amelach shav mechazot ben Eser gano machtov mekatzim netiotel miyabeshim ratov. Vayomer Malach bedmut chavronaz achol atov v'davar biito matov. Essentially, this is a not very good poet who's trying to retell the story of Megillat Esther, and he's using the first words of Hamelach Shav Vayomer, right? He's trying to use the first words of every pasuk. His rhyming's not so good. He's not the world's greatest poet. We don't know who he was, but he was definitely expanding upon earlier piyutim. But finally, it says about the fate of Haman. What that means is that they hung Haman. The Jewish people hung the enemy on the tree, and in his fear, he soiled himself. Meaning that Haman pooped his pants. And everybody said to themselves, Yashuv Amalobro show, that he got what deserved on his head. So this is like the first time that you find in any of the piyutim of Purim, that at least one that's meant for the synagogue, that somebody's taking a stab at humor to some degree. Now, would the rabbis have liked it? I don't really know. Maybe that would have made the rabbis bristle. But someone snuck in a joke there. And if it's not a joke, then maybe it's a medrash that we don't know about, that Haman was so scared that he soiled himself. This is not just one anecdote from this early piyut. Now, one of these piyutim of Shmona Esrei also has a very interesting anecdote, probably from a midrash that none of us know about, or none of us at least know how to find. Apparently, let me find it for you. There we go. Okay. There's the people of Eretz Yisrael had access to Midrashim that we today don't know about. And one of these Midrashim says as follows. It says that Mordechai, at least the way the Piyut describes it, is that Mordechai asked to three children, Pesokli Pesukech. Pesokli Pesukech is a form of prophecy. It's when a distinguished Talmud Chacham will go to children and he'll say, tell me the pasuk that you learned in yeshiva today, because he's seeking a guidance from heaven. And he wants to know what he should do further, and what the child told him is something that he's going to obey. So here's this siluk of Uvchein Aritzach Elokeinu. But I'm just going to start then here. Bayom HaRishon BaMordechai, this is talking about the 3 days of fasting. El petach beit hegyonai besak ve'efer v'rov v'gonai maskir tzidkat shalosh ha'teitanai morid ma'od k'nachalei adonai yatza na'ar lekrato korei betorat Hashem amadu nushakol rosho b'rinonai. He stood and he kissed the boy on his head and his tears fell on him, and amar lo b'ni ma karata hayom emor, tell me what you learned today. Amar adoni karati hayom liyishuatcha kivinu Hashem. He told him, kiviti Hashem. He said that today the pasuk we learned is that you have to pray to Hashem for hope, right? We hope to Hashem for his Yeshua. The same thing happens on day two. He finds another boy and he says, Amar lo b'ni amor p'sukecha lezekenach ulay tesamachu. Amar hanar baruch hagever iftach b'Hashem v'haya Hashem miftacho. The second child tells him also, you have to trust in Hashem and Hashem will help you. Finally, the last kid, ubiado achad asar kitaveo. Amar lo b'ni amor p'sukach lezekenach ulay avir yogoneo. Amar Hanar Bor Korave Chapreu. Finally, the third child tells Mordechai that the Haman dug his own grave, essentially. And this Ukishamar Tavrim Samach Simchat Olamim V'Yadaki Ratza Bo Kel Litomim. Now, the nature of this piyut, just because it's for kedusha of Krovat Yuchet, tells us that it's very late. It's probably from the 10th century, and the style as well. However, it clearly shows that the poet is aware of a midrash that we're not aware of, or that he's embellishing the midrashim of Esther on his own accord. Now, in their times, adding embellishments to legends weren't lying. For them, it wasn't like fabrication. For them, it was a form of positive embellishment. For them, adding details to legend made it more holy and more grand. It wasn't something that they were trying to do to lie. Therefore, it's possible that this is a midrash that we're unaware of, and this would make this early Purim this early Purim poem also not just a source for us for parody, and not just a source for early festivities of Purim, it's also a source for early Midrashim of Purim that might have been lost to us. Okay, Now, as I mentioned, many of these pew team are not liturgical. And in contrast to being liturgical, many of them were written to be said around the table, to be said in public readings, or to be sung. And if we were really to explore the earliest forms of piyut for Purim, we have to leave the synagogue and we have to look for piyutim written for public use. Now, I'm going to take you on a bit of a journey here to a genre of piyutim that we've discussed here before. This is a genre of piyutim called piyute. Let's call it for today. We'll call it piyute bnei marava. Right? These are the earliest piyutim that we know of. Some of the earliest piyutim that we know of that are outside of the Bible. There's a book put out in, I think, 1999 it's called Shirat Bnei Marava by Yosef Yalom and Michael Sokolov. The objective of this book was to decode the earliest types of Jewish poetry. Now, what many people don't know is that the earliest forms of piyut that are known to Judaism were written in Aramaic. Anything that's not biblical, the earliest artistic expressions of Jewish worship and of Jewish culture did not begin in the golden age of Spain. The earliest poetic cultures grew up in Eretz Yisrael in the late, let's call it in the Byzantine era. So essentially, the Jews of Eretz Yisrael that lived in the 200s, the 300s, the 400s, and the 500s, those Jews developed a culture of poetry, and that culture of poetry was primarily in what's called Jewish Palestinian Aramaic, or a dialect of Aramaic specific to the Jews of Eretz Israel in that time. And their poetry came down to us in a few very interesting ways. One way that it came down to us is obviously from the Machzorim of the Greek and the Roman Jews. They maintained a lot of very old piyutim, which were in Aramaic, and these were used for liturgical use. Then we have some piyutim from the Cairo Geniza. We have some piyutim from papyrus from Egypt, literal papyri, which are just old enough that they're almost 2,000 years old. And finally, some of them come from the Megillat, from the Targum Sheni of Esther. So just to explain, how do we know that these are so old? How do we know that these piyutim are actually like 1700 years old, 1800 years old? So one of the ways you know this is, of course, from the language. You cannot fake, especially in poetry, you cannot fake grammar and vocabulary that's that good. You have to be a native speaker of that ancient form of Aramaic to put the mems in the right place, to put the nuns in the right place, to have all the suffixes and prefixes correct, to borrow words from the contemporary Greek, to have an extensive vocabulary. You simply cannot fake that, especially in a literary genre like poetry. Much later, we know that much later, Paitanim from the 12th century tried writing in Aramaic just to show their academic chops. And from a grammar perspective, it's woefully inadequate. Just they don't have any access to contemporary words. They don't understand the grammar perfectly. And they tried, but they couldn't write poetry in a tongue that wasn't their native tongue. Another way that we know that these piyutim are very ancient is that some of these piyutim, especially the ones for Purim, will mention things that cannot be later than the 4th century. For example, one of the piyutim for Purim mentions the gladiator fights of the Colosseums. We know that the Colosseums were closed in the mid-4th century, meaning in the mid-300s, the Colosseums were closed in the Roman Empire when Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire, or at least the Byzantine Empire, though they saw it as the Roman Empire, they closed the Colosseums. And therefore, if these early piyutim, these early parodies from that were written in this Aramaic mention the Colosseums or gladiator fights, they must be from the mid-300s, which is just astonishingly old. Now, as I said, one of the other sources for this is the Targum Sheni of Esther. The Targum Sheni of Esther is a fascinating Targum. It's really a medrash, and it's pictured here from the, I believe it's the Valmonada. I forgot how to pronounce that. Give me a second. It's the Valmadona one, or the Sassoon 282. There's essentially two ways of describing that manuscript. But the Valmadonna one is a manuscript, an early manuscript of the Targum Sheni from the 1100s. It's a fascinating manuscript because it's written like a month before the persecutions of the Jews of York and the Jews of England by the coronation of King Richard. So this is like the only Hebrew Bible that we have from England in the, I think it was July 6th, 1189 or some absurd date like that, like almost a month before the Jews really escaped that region. But for some reason, this Bible, this Tanakh, survived, and in it had a Targum. And this is the Targum Sheni, the second Targum, which is really a very embellished, it's a very embellished Midrashic Targum from the early, from early Eretz Yisrael. The language, the Aramaic, is good enough that we can tell it's probably from the 4th or 5th century in Eretz Yisrael. And in it, there's a lot of Piyutim for Purim. And so this incredible Targum also gives us a window into the Piyutim for Purim. Now, I'm going to go through a few of them with you here, just because some are funny. And they're all, besides being funny, they're all very much worth seeing. So let's see what I can go through with you here. So here's the first. Here's the first one. The first piyut that I want to see together, and I'm going to show you pictures of the book Shirat B'nei Ma'arava. The first one here is one that's about, it is essentially like a parody where it's Haman HaRasha. It's Haman from the story. It's Haman appealing and talking to all the evil people who tried to persecute the Jews in the history of the Jewish people. Haman is speaking to all of them. And one by one, all of them say, "Oh, you have it so bad, look at me." And finally we get down to here. Look at this piyut with me together. Savar at bigramach, right? Salav legarmach ba'ana shotef imach, right? So this is the finally at the very end of the poem, we have Jesus, or in Jewish terms, Yeshu, who himself comes and tells Haman, "You think it's so bad? You're on your cross and I'm on my cross." I'm going to show you here the Hebrew translation versus the original Aramaic. You see, in the Septuagint and in the Christian versions of the Bible, they believe that Haman was crucified, even though the Jewish sources never say this. But the Jews were aware of this. They probably thought it was funny. They knew it wasn't. Probably most of them knew it wasn't true. If you look at the Hebrew Bible, in other words, the Bible, if you look at the Megillas Esther, it's clear that he was hung on a tree, or he was hung on a large wooden pole. He wasn't hung on a. He wasn't crucified. But a lot of the Christians believe that Haman was crucified. So if we just translate here, Yeshu is telling him, it says, "Me'une bashot yilud isha bekaruli ben Elohim simar b'masmarim musumarim b'yavarei tov mimeni ochal sorim sofoshal enikuv notnim lecherpa b'chol v'yir v'yir amar ploni." Essentially, he's saying, I'm sorry, that I, the son of a woman, meaning an actual baby who was born, not a god. I was sakif bestikutus. I'm sitting here on the. I am stuck on a pole. Minatazin tus, meaning the son of that. I'm not sure if this means woman or it's a pejorative word for a woman, like a whore. Vekaron yati Christos, and they called me. They called me the Christos. Samar b'mesmarin, and I was tied up. Begapai mesmarim. Banged into my organs. Tav mini achal sarin. Essentially, like, horses are better than me. This is essentially Yeshu making fun of himself, that he was called Christos, and however he was taken to the deepest humiliation and crucified on a cross. So this is a really interesting. This, of all the Piyutim from the 300-400s, this one's interesting. First of all, yes, it's funny. But on the other, it's funny if you're Jewish. If you're a Christian, this is not funny at all. But if you're essentially, the other reason that this is interesting is because this tells us that the Jews decided that it was totally fine and funny to equate Haman with Yeshu and to make the holiday of Purim and the parodies of Haman kind of equal to the mockery they would make of Jesus, because why not? It's just as funny. And if you really do believe that Jesus was crucified, that Haman was crucified, well, so was Yeshu, so why not? And What ends up happening is that we know for sure that Theodosius II, who was one of the Byzantine kings, issued a proclamation. This is in the Theodosian Code 16.8.18. He issued a proclamation banning all the Jews from burning Haman-like effigies. Because apparently what the Jews would do is that they would take a doll that looked like Haman, and they would crucify it and then burn it while, you know, singing and laughing and drunkenly dancing. So I'll just read a few here. The governors of the provinces shall prohibit the Jews from setting fire to a man in recollection of his past punishment in a certain ceremony of their festival, and from burning with sacrilegious intent a form similar to the Holy Cross in contempt of the Christian faith, so that they do not mix the sign of our faith with their jokes, but they shall restrain their rights from the contempt of Christian law, for they without a doubt will lose what has been permitted to them until now, unless they abstain from that which has been forbidden. In other words, watch out, because all the rights and privileges we've given to you, we're going to take away if you dare do this again. Essentially, what we see is that in the 400s, the Jews thought it was funny, if not hilarious, to go ahead and write jokes and poems and plays and theater and have all sorts of fun mocking Haman HaRasha, but also incorporating into it a mockery of Christianity. This is fascinating because at that time in the 400s, Christianity was a very new religion, and it was new to the statehood, to the government, to have a state religion. And so we see there's a pushback from the civilian population, especially the minorities like the Jews, who are saying like, yeah, nope, yeah, we don't care. It's kind of funny that your government wants to have a state religion, but we really don't care. And they decided to make as much fun of the religion as they could. As the centuries moved on and the church became much more ascendant, and the church became a much more powerful political movement, which was more than just a habit or a favorite pet of the government, this kind of revelry became much more dangerous. It wasn't just something that the king could write one edict and say, no, stop doing that, or else. It was going to be something that would be much, much, much more dangerous for the Jews to try. Okay, but let's go back to our piyutim from the Jews of Eretz Yisrael. Here's one where where this mimics the midrash, which is known to us. There's a midrash which discusses all of the trees fighting over who should or should not be the one to hang Haman. And if you look here on the bottom, Sokolov and Yahalom put together a list of the Targum Sheni, the Esther Rabbah, and the different manuscripts, which all have different lists of all the trees: the Gefen, the Teina, the Rimon, the Egos, the Etrog, the Hadas, the Zait, the Tapuach, all the different trees who were fighting and finally got the, I think it was the Erez or the Kotz, it depends on the version, which essentially won the cedar tree or the thorn tree, which essentially won this fight. And so we find here, it begins, Hazinu li hates atitu li alana bechol shati liya, deshati lu min yoma debreshit, devar hamadata ba'il masak la chalsanira, le alkasnaraya, which we don't know what it means, devar panda shel ban padira. In other words, Hazinu li ha'etim bechol anetiyot shenishtalu min yom bereshit sheben hamadata bikesh la'alot, Haman is asking to get hanged, l'alexandria shel ben pandira. We don't know exactly what that means, but I believe Ben Pandira is a euphemism for Yeshu, meaning in the same way as Yeshu got killed. And finally, we have this banter going on back and forth. Finally, I think it's the Erez that wins. Now, finally, the last one that I want to discuss is the Kina of Zeresh. This one got a little bit more famous because in the time of the Piyutim of Eretz Yisrael, the Kina was one of their most favorite genres. Now, in part of their culture was to hire people to recite eulogies and to recite dirges for people who had passed away. And the women especially were very moved by this. It was a very big part of the culture for women to recite and to listen to dirges and elegies and keynotes. So this was a huge part of their culture. And once a genre becomes typified or entrenched enough that it's worthy of parody, that's when you know that it's already quite old. It's at least 50 years old or something. It's definitely decades old. This one is called... I believe it's called There's really no title to Putim in that time, but some people will call it Ayalat Zeresh, or the sighs of Zeresh. So essentially, I'll read it to you here in Aramaic. Let's do it in Hebrew, actually. Bishashin Salvu Aseret Bnei Haman. In the time when the 10 sons of Haman were crucified, Yelala Zeresh Vitzaka, as Zeresh, their mother, cried out, Eit Zedek Mehaman Shetaman Lanu Pach. How terrible is Haman, who set a trap for us. B'chol Shana B'chol Zman Omrim Arur Haman. Every year and every time we will sing Arur Haman. And then over and over, there's this rhyme at the end, which is Waila Uma Mateta Albira, and then the name of the son. So Waila Uma Matata in Aramaic would mean Oila Uma Shekrauta, woe and I don't know what the English word is for this, but oh, and woe is to Zeresh, and for what happened to her on her son Parshandata. Waila Uma Matata Albira Dalfon. Finally, at the end of this is the kind of thing which you really can't say in the synagogue. Here we have the final part where she says as follows: Kara Haman be kitvai delai yeho Yehudai salvon yata viat panoi vishtairat ana lebal chudai. Right. So Haman wrote in his book that there will no longer be Jews. They crucified him and his sons, and I am left myself. Raima havina b'amatai b'avdai. I'm left alone with my servants and maidservants. Waila uma mateta albera aridai. And woe unto me for my son aridai. Finally, shimema anayativa. Alone I sit. Min kol zaviata. Wherever I go, I feel alone. Anau baita masarin bista. Me and my household were given for plunder. Talat chavla bekadla. She tied a noose around her neck, v'hanakta garma zenita, and the whore essentially choked herself. Waila uma matata albara vaizata. Essentially, it rhymes with zanita. So waila uma matata, oila uma shekara for her son zanita, her son vaizuta. Very interesting. So we have many legends about what happened to Zeresh. For example, that she became a maidservant of Esther, or that she fled the country with her sons, with the rest of her sons. But this is not a medrash that we're aware of, that she went ahead and committed suicide. That's not a medrash that we're aware of. Most likely, he's making this up, the author, and it was just kind of funny. This is not the kind of thing, of course, that you could sing in the synagogue. I just can't imagine. It calls her a zona, a whore, more than once in this poem. So I just cannot imagine that this is the kind of thing that was put into a synagogue prayer. And one last thing I'll show you is here. This is Piyut Chavav. At the end, it just dates itself a little. It says, Mandat paramin kadmaya hui shisei achrai vitinakamin romaya v'sirkaya biad ama Yehudai. One of these poems says that the Hashem who gave retribution for our forefathers, who should also give retribution and punish our most recent tormentors, and Hashem should exact revenge on the Romans and on the Arabs by the hands of the Jews. Fascinating. Piyutim. This is all from the 300s, 400s, and 500s. So this is really the earliest Piyutim, which have a sense of humor, they have parody, and they're topical. They teach us a lot about the, not a lot, but quite a bit about the culture of the Jews at the time and how they interacted with Goyim of their era. Now, let's move on a little bit and go further into medieval times. If we leave the Dark Ages and we go past the time of Reblozer HaKalir, like go past the 600s, the 700s, the 800s, when they're only developing one or two piyutim here and there for the Shemein Esrei of Purim, when we move into the Middle Ages in the 1000s and 1100s, we have many more piyutim being written. Now, these piyutim especially in the golden era of Spain, we find, at least from what I found so far, the Spanish piyutim that occur for Purim, at least from what I can see, are synagogal but much more elegant, while the Ashkenazis seem to, as far as I could tell, they seem to retain more of a humorous and parodic element to them. So let's start with this. I'll show you the Machzor Vitri. The Machzor Vitri was probably from the early 12th century. And in the Machzor Vitri, it prescribes a poem for the nighttime by Arvit. Let me share my screen here. Here by Arvit, instead of Leil Shimurim that we know from Pesach, this is a parody called Leil Shikurim Huzeh HaLaila. Right, this tonight is the night of drunkenness. Lismoach b'yayin hatov v'lagila. Purim al shem hapur nekra b'gila yiskol anu b'kriyat megila. Hamariv b'leil hazeh yishakru kol yitzurim lehizacher chok asher nikva b'purim. Arur ha'ish asher yado yarim lishtot mayim hameorarim. It's fun. It's a beautiful poem. And it's shocking that they actually prescribed to say this in shul after Arvit. But this was the fun of Purim. And this seems to be maybe a hint that perhaps people liked getting drunk on the night of Purim as well in 11th century or 12th century France. However, in Spain, I don't think we find this. Now, maybe I'm wrong. In subsequent years, I'll know more. But in Spain, at least the Piyutim of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi are very elegant. They're not really humorous. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi focused most of his poetic oeuvre on Purim to the Shabbat Zachor, which is before Purim. And on Shabbat Zachor, he dedicates these beautiful piyutim, whether it's a reshut, whether it's a nishmat, a mi kamocha. He dedicates these piyutim to the love of Hashem for Klal Yisrael and how Hashem saved us from Haman. And these are honestly beautiful piyutim. And you could look them up in Dov Yardain's compendium of Yehuda HaLevi's Shirim. I think it's from page 250 and onward in volume 1. It's available online for free on the Dov Yardain website. The most famous of all of these is Mi Kamocha Ve'en Kamocha Mi Nidmalach. And I know that this poem is still said today by Sephardic congregations everywhere. They don't put it in the proper place, which was in the Mi Kamocha of Kriyat Shema, but that's all Piyutim they took out of the standard, out of the formal liturgy, but they took it out. And a lot of Jews will say it, a lot of Sephardic Jews will say it before Kriyat HaTorah, or they'll say it before Baruch She'amar. I am actually not sure about the first part about this, the Mi Kamocha Ve'en Kamocha, that beginning stanza, it's not there in the earliest versions, so I'm not sure if this came later. You see, what happened was is that in following centuries, many authors mimicked Mi Kamocha Ve'en Kamocha. So I'm not entirely sure if that what sentences of it are original, which aren't. I know there were some books written on Mi Kamocha Ve'en Kamocha, I think by Rafael Chazan, his name was, a scholar who covered the development of Mi Kamocha Ve'en Kamocha. I think it was, let's see. Yeah, I think it was, his name is Ephraim Chazan. I'm sorry. Ephraim Chazan wrote a sefer on Mi Kamocha Ve'en Kamocha. And just as an example, some locations in Europe, they had a Purim Sheni. Right? People would have, for all different reasons, if there was a miraculous salvation from the non-Jews, they would have a Purim Sheni. And in those Purims, they would write their own piyutim. And oftentimes they were in Hebrew, oftentimes they were, more often, they were in Ladino. And they would write these expressions of joy and parodies to celebrate those times. One that I'm thinking off the top of my head is I think it's called Purim Edom, when the Spanish unsuccessfully tried to take the port of Algiers in 1541, I think it was. When the Spanish were unsuccessful, the Jews were very relieved because the Spanish had the court of the Inquisition, and the Spanish were forcibly Christian. So when they repelled the invasion, the Jews made a Purim for that. They also made a Purim in the 1700s. And we have, from that era, we have entire books in Ladino. We have entire books of Piyutim from that era. Let me share my screen with you one more time, just to show you some of those Sfarim that we have. This is, let me just catch up to my slideshow. This is Bernard Grossfeld, who was a musmach. He was a Talmud of Moshe Feinstein. He was a big expert on Targum, and he wrote the translation of Targum Sheni. Furthermore, we have, if you want, anybody's interested, one here is an interview with Rabbi Grossfeld, and another here is a link to a video about the Codex Valmadonna, which is the most important of the of the codexes on Targum Sheni. This is Yehuda Levi. And finally, here are these earlier books that we have, the Canción de Purim. The Jews also were very, very much like the type of Spanish song called the coplas. And the Jewish, in Ladino, they would what's it called, compose many of these coplas type poems. I think they had quatrains or something like that. It's kind of like today we have Gramen. The Spanish had their own version. They had their own songs, which they liked. And they would, you know, make a lot of Purim songs in that style. Now, one more thing I should speak about just when we're on the topic of parody is outside of the realm of poetry, there were, of course, many parodies written for Purim. And some of the most famous ones already began in the 14th and 13th centuries, the Rabbi Kilonimus Bar Klonimus. Rabbi Kilonimus Bar Klonimus wrote the famous Masechet Purim, which is like a parody on the Talmud. And here I'll just show you the end of it. Hadran alach en korin v'slich alach Masechet de Purim v'rachamid ishmai avinun arba parkin v'din saman hon v'adar ha'ashi Purim en korin. It's a really funny, if you're fluent in Talmud, you'll enjoy Masechet Purim. It's available in many, many different versions. It's not as well read today, but there was a time when knowing Masechet Purim was almost like the Aleph Beis of Purim, because so many later parodies were modeled on Masechet Purim. Also, or the Ralbag wrote something called, I think it was Masechet Starim, in a similar vein. This is a version of Masechet Purim, which says, Hakol Chayavin, Leil Shikurim Huzeh HaLaila. It says somewhere here on this page, it says that everyone is chayav to gamble and play dice on this day, which is kind of funny. But this is the one of the many, many versions. I think this is from the Belinsky collection, this version here of Masechet Purim. Now, if anyone wants to study parody more deeply, there's none other than the king himself, Yisrael Davidson, who finds it funny to take two profile photos of himself, one with a pipe, one without a pipe. But he wrote a very important book called Parody in Jewish Literature. And in this book, which is available for free online if you want it, it's also available. You could get it printed by Amazon for $30. In this book, he, in the early 1900s, he probably did one of the most important reviews of parody in Jewish literature. He spends a couple of chapters discussing these parodies, such as the parody of Kleinimus Bar Kleinimus and the parody of the Ralbag. What's most important about those parodies, just to give you historical context, is that those parodies actually give us a lot of information about contemporary culture, while the later ones are just copies of the original ones. So they give us less information about the contemporary culture. It's not until many hundreds of years later when people start to get almost like original again, and they start adding, They start adding elements into their parodies, which give us a glimpse into contemporary culture. Now, Davidson's important because he has a list, as does Moritz Steinschneider in German. Moritz Steinschneider and Yisrael Davidson and Avraham Meir Haberman also has a shorter list of all the piyutim of Purim that were parodies. And I think it's probably around 100 that we know of, Ad Yom Hazeh. And honestly, every year there are more. Every year somebody else is publishing a new song or a new poem or a new parody for Purim. And it keeps everybody entertained, to be honest. And I feel like there is what to be gleaned from, if you want to get dry and academic about it, of course, there's what to be gleaned from studying the poetry and to studying the piyut. But on the other hand, some of it is not taken too seriously. Like sometimes you with the hindsight, will take some of these piyutim more seriously than they took themselves. When the piyut itself was written in jest, you don't always know if the piyut itself should be taken so seriously and if you could take everything inside these piyutim as fact. On the flip side, parody in Jewish literature is a really important genre. There are many subtypes of this genre. There's many subtypes of parody, of the genre of parody in Jewish literature. There's many subtypes of the genre of Purim parody. But in general, in Jewish parody, what we find is that, as Charles Davidson puts it, is that you have the preacher disguised as the jester. Very often, the person who is making the jokes in a Jewish parody is giving a veiled criticism to the people of his time. This is honestly true comedy, where you're finding a way to take your observations and your criticisms of contemporary life, contemporary Jewry, or contemporary oppressors, and to find ways to make it funny and to find ways to criticize ourselves and to criticize other people, which won't get you in too much trouble. And that's just really where, you know, Jewish humor has always shined, in the ability to criticize and the ability to criticize ourselves and other people without getting in too much trouble. This is really why, as a minority, we've always excelled at parody, because we had to always toe that line between the permissible and the impermissible, what was going to get us in real trouble or what was just going to be someone was going to let it slide. And we always had to be able to carefully dance across that line. That's really the beauty of Jewish parody. So now there's hundreds of years, at least especially the modern era and in the medieval era of Jewish poetry and parody that we did not cover tonight. And I really wish that we could, and we should. There's parody in Hebrew, there's parody in Yiddish, there's piyutim and poetry in Ladino, and in every language there were piyutim and poems written for Purim. Bezrat Hashem, in the coming years, I will know more about these. We will discuss them. Maybe I'll know. I didn't have time to get to that Sefer on Mikamocha. I hope to get to it. And Bezrat Hashem, we will know more as we trudge along. So thank you, everybody, for your time and for your attention. And if anybody has any questions, or anybody has information that I'm unaware of, please let me know. I would love to learn more about the Piyutim of Purim. And everybody should have a Purim Sameach. And with that, I will pause the recording.